I live in Israel. This season is dedicated to the memory of the 1,400 of my countrymen who were massacred on October 7th and the 240 people that were kidnapped and are being held hostage by the terrorist organization Hamas. Hopefully they will be returned to their families as soon as possible, and hopefully this terrible war will be able to come to a peaceful end very soon. Welcome to Minute 11 of Season 6 of Movie Around Minute, the daily podcast where we take a Capra-esque journey through the 1946 classic, It's a Wonderful Life, one minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me today is David Brook of Blueprint Review. Welcome back to the show this season, David.
Hello, good to be back. Always a pleasure to be on the Movie Around Minute.
Yeah, and everyone gets to hear you every day because, you know, this is, I think, the third season that you've done the music for, so,
you know. Oh, yeah, true.
You get the intro and the outro from David Brook, so once again, thank you very much. Yeah, hey, I have no complaints about it. I love your music and your voice, so it works. So thank you. Thank you very much for that again. It's much appreciated.
Always a good excuse to get on the old keys.
There you go.
Yeah.
I'm glad I've given you a good excuse to do so. So minute 11 begins with Potter besmirching the Bailey's tendency to do good and ends with George taking some more hits from Gower. So, I mean, we ended things on Friday with the whole idea that, you know, George wanted to, you know, he saw the sign last week and he was, you know, that says, you know, ask your father. And he decided that he was going to go, you know, speak to one of the smartest men that he knows, Peter Bailey, to get some sort of suggestion from him as to what he's supposed to do about this, this poison pill, as they say, which we talked a little more about that last week, about why it's, or how it's possible that they can actually have poison in a drugstore. But, you know, and then he ended up going to the savings and loan. And obviously there's the whole issue, you know, that we talked about last week, that how did Potter actually get up to the second floor since we don't see that there's an elevator, you know, so somehow he got his wheelchair up there. I still believe that Potter is one of those people that is faking being in a wheelchair. You know, like he gets to the bottom of the steps, you know, I've seen it somewhere. I don't remember where, maybe it was, I think it was in the movie Chaplin. I think it was, you know, Richard Attenborough's Chaplin in 1992, where they're trying to, you know, to edit. I think it's the Great Dictator, and they show him like pretending that he's dressed up as a woman in a wheelchair, and they drive him, you know, they wheel him around in the wheelchair, and they get to some steps, and then he stands up, walks up the steps, and then sits that back down in the wheelchair after he goes up the steps, you know, and puts like a blanket over his legs. So it just reminded me that maybe that's what Potter is doing here also. You know, it would be funny actually seeing him do it at like fast speed, you know, the way that they used to do things in, you know, silent movies and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, basically George would interrupts his father in the middle of the conversation with Potter. And, you know, Potter, at the end of, on Friday, he started saying some pretty nasty things about the Baileys. And he goes, oh, I suppose I should give it to. And then today he continues with miserable failures like you and that idiot brother of yours to spend for me. So, I mean, that's a really harsh thing to say. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, there are very few people that will claim that Potter is, you know, a nice man, but this is, you know, to say that to someone's face, you know, like, so my question then would be is why is he always investing in the savings and loan? You know, like obviously he must be making money somehow on that because he wouldn't do that. But, you know, for him to say that, you know, well, you know, Potter shouldn't have to, you know, save up his money and that he should give more money to them in the savings and loan, which just, again, doesn't make any sense. I mean, we find out later in the movie that he buys up more of the savings and loan. You know, he gets on the board and stuff like that in order to be able to have a little more control over things, you know,
Trying to take it
in the
over.
Town. Exactly.
Yeah.
But he must be trying to take it over because it is profitable in some ways. You know, it doesn't make sense for him to want it. Potter is not a guy who's just going to do it for the sake of doing it. You know, he has something going on.
It's competition, isn't it? Yeah, it's competition.
Yeah, but if it's competition that he wants to close down, then he should just try and close it down. I mean, as opposed to join, you know, it's the whole adage of, you know, if you can't beat him, join him.
Yeah.
You know, so I don't know. It's very strange. And at this point, George basically defends his father and just screams out and says, he's not a failure. You can't say that about my father, which is pretty commendable for you know, what is he supposed to be, like 12 at this point? I think he's supposed to be 12.
Yeah, something like that.
You got to give George a lot of credit for, even at that age, you know, he didn't know what he was supposed to do with the poison, but, you know, he's there to defend his father at all costs.
Yeah, and I think it's all part of, like most of these early scenes, and this one in particular, it's all about setting the scene and setting the characters, really. And it's but doing it efficiently, it kind of jumps through a lot of these flashbacks. Obviously, the flashbacks get longer in a minute compared to where we began. But it's showing you that he stands up for people, especially his family.
That's right.
Doing it through a scene rather than just telling you like. Less of the screenplays would do, so it's a nice one.
Yeah, right. That's true, and I mean, at this point, Peter Bailey tries to calm George down, you know, which says something about him also. That you know, he, on the one hand, he might agree with what George is saying, but he knows that's not the way to do it. You know, you're not going to be able to get what you want from Potter by screaming at him. You have to do it in a more diplomatic way. Whatever it is. We'll never find out what the diplomatic way is, because we don't see how Peter Bailey does it, but we do see the fact that he is, you know, calmly trying to calm George down. You know, he goes, George, quiet, George. And then George screams out, you're the biggest man in town. You know, which again, it shows, I wonder if this is the Capra's way of talking about like his feelings towards his own father, you know, when he was creating this character, because, you know, most of the, I mean, this story is, it's based on a 23 page story, but there's very little connection, you know, between the two stories, besides the fact of a man who wants to die, you know, and then, you know, realizes how important life is, you know, because he gets to see what life would be like without it. So there are elements that are connected to it, but this is not there at all. I mean, this is purely something that the scriptwriters came up with. I mean, there were so many different drafts of this that they end up meshing them all together. So we never know who the person is that thought of this idea. But I mean, one of the things you can see in this movie is that, as you alluded to, you know, there a lot of the scenes at the beginning are reflections of things that will happen later on. You know, so that we get to see the characters and the way that they, you know, the way that they're developed over the course of the movie. And this is just a prime example of it, that George will do anything to help anybody when he can, even if it means arguing with the most powerful man in town, who George doesn't believe that. George believes that his father is. And then Peter says to him, run along.
It's setting up the rivalry between them as well, because obviously he's the film's bad guy and George is the film's good guy, I guess.
Correct.
And it's just setting that up nice and early.
Yeah. And then George continues by saying, he says to him, you're the biggest man in town and you're bigger than him. Meaning, even at this age, George can see through the facade of Potter. Which is great to see. You know, we hear Potter grumble in the back, says, gives you an idea of the Baileys, you know, which he's basically at this point besmirching George. He's basically saying, look, you know, even this 12-year-old kid is just going to say whatever he wants. You know, that's the way these Baileys are, you know, that type of thing. And then George screams up again. He says, don't let him say that about you, Pop. All right, son. All right. Thanks. I'll talk to you tonight. And like he sort of pushes him out the door. as he's doing that. Again, knowing that you know, there's no point in having this argument in front of Potter. You know, and obviously the funny thing is when you think of the story, I mean, George comes to his father for help and he doesn't get the help that he wants because Potter is there disturbing things. He wanted great advice from his father. And the advice he gets from his father is okay, don't fight with Potter. You know, we need him for things also. You know, I think that's part of the lesson that Peter Bailey is showing here, that the idea is okay. You know, sometimes you need to keep quiet in order to get things done that need to get done. You know, in order to let the savings and loan work and stuff like that. So sometimes you have to be somewhat complacent to people like Potter, even though you don't agree with everything that they say or do and stuff like
Yeah,
that. You know,
yeah.
and it also brings up the whole idea of you know, is George's personality. Do you think George's personality is the whole idea of nature versus nurture?
Oh, I never thought of it like that, really. I guess it could be. I guess because he's kind of got, yeah, I don't know. I kind of, yeah, that's an interesting way of thinking, really. Because it's obviously throughout the film, I guess the idea is he's got his dreams and he's got the things that he wants to do, but his surroundings and those around him hold him back. But it's not necessarily them holding him back. It's his dedication to them, his kind of love for them and support for them that is. It's not holding him back. It's just it's helping. Yeah, it's helping them, but not helping his own selfish needs.
Right.
Is the ultimate thing, but I guess, yeah, it could be linked to that in a way.
You know, the idea that he grew up in this household of people that are always giving, you know, and therefore
Taking after his
he
father, yeah.
learned from that, okay, that's what you do. You know, but on the other hand, his talking out in front of Potter is not necessarily something that he would have learned from his father. Unless at
No.
home his father is always talking bad about Potter. You know, I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, at the dinner table he's like, oh, that idiot Potter, you know, drove me nuts again today. He was trying to do this and that and the other thing. You know, oh, I wish I could stop that man. I don't know, but I need him. So, you know, we never find that out. But you know, but again, it's great seeing George's personality at this age, knowing what his personality will be. You know, when he's older.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah.
And Potter notices right away that this is a Bailey trait. You know, he doesn't necessarily know that in the future he's going to have to deal with the Baileys this way. But as far as he's concerned, you know, they're, you know, the George is very similar to Peter. And maybe I need to watch out for him. So at this point, you know, we see George standing outside of the door of the office, and he looks like he's in complete despair and doesn't know what to do. And then the scene changes, and
Nice and white.
yeah. Oh, the wipes in this movie are amazing. You know, you know, Capra really knew how to show. Okay, now we're going somewhere else, and it's going to be a completely different tone and look and feel of everything.
It did make me think watching these scenes actually. I was just thinking, with the era these were made, obviously wipes are very easy to do these days. But it did make me really curious, especially as being an editor myself, is how they actually did the wipes in the old kind of splicing film days. Because if you freeze frame it, it's not like a clean like cut wipe. It's like a faded edge. You know, I always wonder how they did that in those days. I find it intriguing. I'll have to do some research. But
Yeah, I never looked that up to see how
no,
to see how that's done.
that's all right.
Sorry.
Oh, before we go into the next scene as well, I just want a quick another nice and it's not another nice little thing that they do. I think he Crapper clearly frames it so that you can see the big writing of Peter Bailey above the door when it closes, and I think that's again a nice little bit of reinforcement of the storytelling in that it's because as I say, these early scenes when he's a kid rush along quite a bit. So getting across the names of who's who, and just it with a little a little kind of extra little detail like that, rather than just hearing someone say the name. Because I don't know about you, but for me, I'm terrible at remembering names. Unless I see things written down, I can never remember names at all. I need a lot of reinforcement. So little things like that, I think support the storytelling, in their own little ways.
Yeah, I mean, I've been listening to the commentary. There's a commentary that you can actually even find online, Professor Janine Bassinger. From Wesleyan College, and she's apparently one of the biggest experts on this movie. I sent her an email, I sent her actually two emails, and she didn't respond. Yeah. She's probably in her 80s, if not beyond that at this point. So I can understand why she might not have responded for that reason, but I've listened to her commentary, and it's a very interesting commentary because the movie is a little over 2 hours, but the commentary that I found on YouTube is like an hour and a half. And instead of showing the movie, part of the scenes are moving and most of them are just pictures. You know, so you get to hear all of her, ideas about the movie and stuff like that.
Is it more like a lecture almost?
Yeah. In some ways it is. But she does talk about, the idea of the reflection between the stuff that happens at the beginning of George's life and things that happen later on.
Mm.
And she talks a little bit about the various actors. She talked about H.B. Warner, who plays Mr. Gower, who we'll get back to, but we talked about him last week also a little bit. I find it interesting to listen to it, but I really searched high and low to try and find a commentary. It's not like I was able to on the Die Hard 2 Blu-ray, you had Rennie Harlan's commentary, which worked really well to tell me a lot about what was going on in the background. But here, this is mostly, just having to listen to film thoughts of, the information of what was known at the time. So one of the things that Janine Bassinger talks about is the fact that Capra is a very visual director, and he uses visual storytelling the same way that they did during the silent film era. A lot about I mentioned this last week, the scenes last week with showing Gower. And we get to read the telegram, and we get to see the skull and crossbone on the on the medicine and all these different things that he doesn't need to outright say things. He can just show them and that how that works and allows us to get a better understanding of what's going on in the story as that goes along.
It's the best way of doing it. I'm a big fan of it. So that's the one thing I keep banging on about. I got a habit of bad mouthing Christopher Nolan in particular. He's a very dialogue led writer and director, and it bothers me. And I think it really holds his films back. I always cite that some of the older directors who were more steeped in the silent era just do it so much more poetically and efficiently, and you aren't bogged down by talk.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, you have both. I mean, this is a very wordy script. I don't know if you took a look at the subtitles, the subtitle file that I put in there, but some of the episodes here, that we're talking about this week are, 2.5-3 pages, just for a minute.
Yeah.
So there is a lot of dialogue explaining things that are going on. It works. So as you said, the screen wipes to the next scene, and then we're back in the drugstore, and we hear a lot of commotion, and we see we see him show up in the drugstore again, and he's getting ready to go back to work. He's taking off his hat, and then we hear from the other room Gower saying, "What? Why that medicine should have been there an hour ago. It'll be over in 5 minutes, Mrs. Blaine." And it's great how we can hear the way that Gower slurs as he's talking, knowing that, we can still hear that he's drunk,
It's pretty good drunk acting, I think, especially for the era. I think drunk acting can be a bit kind of comical, but I think it's quite effective. It's done quite big, but it's not done kind of silly big, if you know what I mean. Right. It's done big enough to notice, but not gone too far into kind of parody.
Right. And I mean, I think it's great also the fact that we see that he's unshaven, and we see that it looks like he's either on the verge of crying or he's been crying so much, that you can really see on his face that something is really there to bother him.
Yeah, especially I think the earlier scene, even in one of the previous minutes, even more so, you definitely see those tears.
Yeah, for sure. But like right now, when he gets off the phone, you can see it also. And he looks over at George and goes, "Where's Mrs. Blaine's box of capsules?" And he goes, "I, you." And he goes, "Didn't you hear what I say?" "Yes, sir. I, what kind of tricks are you playing anyway? Why didn't you deliver them right away? Don't you know the boy's very sick?" And as he's doing this, I mean, first of all, he like chases George around a little bit. And George is very surprised that Mr. Gower is talking to him this way, which, I think is also great because it shows that whatever connection George had with Mr. Gower, George is even shocked by the fact that Mr. Gower is acting this way. He understands that the tragedy that just happened, and that's why he's doing it, but he's still not ready. They sometimes say that when people get drunk or when they're really tired, that's when you get to see who they really are. Because people can't put up their guard anymore and stuff like that. So I don't know what that says about Mr. Gower, if he's always keeping himself in check, but he possibly can get very mad at little things like this. I don't know. And he like grabs George by the shirt as he does it, and he pulls him into the back room. Also, did you notice the way that this scene is being shot? I mean, we talked a little bit about
Yeah,
this
it's
last week
fantastic.
also, that it's being shot through the various shelves. Mr. Gower and George are in the back, and you get to see all of these different bottles and funnels and all the different things that a druggist needs to get their work done. But we don't see them directly. We see them through the shelves, and it gives you the feeling that it's be like that we're being somewhat voyeuristic, looking at
Yeah,
everything
absolutely.
through that.
Yeah, absolutely. It adds depth as well. It's just a much nicer shot. And again, it does remind you who this guy is and what he's doing. I mean, obviously you might not need it as much at this point in the story, but certainly in the earlier scene, it's a really nice way of doing it without having to resort to lots of kind of cheesy close-ups and cuts. It does it. I mean, it's not all one shot. There are cuts, but he tries to minimize that, so it's not just lazy kind of close up of someone talking, close up of the pills or whatever, close up of this. It does it more eloquently. I
Yes.
don't know, really nice.
Yeah, it really does. And then he starts slapping him. And I didn't notice this. This is the first time I noticed this. We get a 2 second shot of Mary reacting to listening to the slapping noise. Meaning that
And there's a
she
little,
and we see that she like jerks her shoulders a little bit, that she's got her ice cream in her hand, but she's still paying attention to what's going on with George. And
There's
I
a l
mean,
little tear as well. I think I was just looking
that's
now and
right.
pausing it.
That's right. You can see on her face how scared she is for George. And I find it really interesting. I mean, this is a little bit of a spoiler, but I'm assuming that most people who are listening to this have seen the whole movie.
I
But
so.
it's never brought up between, George and Mary at some point that she knows that he went through this when he was a kid. And she doesn't necessarily know the reasoning behind it. She just
No.
knows that Gower slapped him. Maybe, they're not going to show her again over the next, the rest of the scene. So maybe she does hear everything, and maybe she also is keeping the secret. But yeah, we never will know. But I think it's really telling. The fact that Capra chose to show us 2 seconds of Mary listening in on this conversation, it opens up a whole can of worms as to, does she ever say anything to George about this that she knows? Or does she also keep this to her, just like George keeps a secret, is she also keeping a secret for the rest of her life about this?
It also acts to kind of help to start showing how much she cares about what happens to him as well, I guess, as for later on. And also just as a kind of an editing trick, having her reaction to the hit helps increase the impact of the hit as well. So it kind of works in those basic levels.
Right, but it's also a way to let us hear the slapping just like Mary without having to see it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, my understanding is that HBO Warner had a really, really difficult time doing the scene, you know, because of the fact that he's slapping around, you know, a young actor at the time.
There might be another reason why they shot it behind those bottles so that he could really miss and it wouldn't be quite as noticeable. So maybe that's why they kept that shot going.
Right. Right. And then we hear like George sobbing a little bit as he's being hit and we see like blood coming out of his ear. And then he basically says to Mr. Gower, he goes, "You're hurting my sore ear," which is really interesting. Again, that you know, we never really know what happened to his ear. We know that, you know, he jumped in the water and that he had pneumonia and that he lost his hearing in there, you know, but if he can't hear from that, so how is that a sore ear? It's not as if his ear bothers him. You know, I mean, a little later in the week, we'll talk a little bit more about that because that'll come up again, the whole thing. You know, and George, what's really interesting here is that George is somewhat trying to defend himself, but he's still not telling Mr. Gower what's going on.
No.
You know, Mr. Gower's really upset and he's not really trying that hard to calm him down because he understands that, you know, Gower is in a state of mind that it doesn't matter what he's going to say to him at this point.
Yeah, or he might not believe him.
Yeah, you know, he's not going to be able to. And then Gower says to him, "You lazy loafer." Have you ever heard that phrase before? A loafer?
I've heard loafer before, yeah.
What's a loafer? Do you know?
A loafer? Well, it's just someone who's lazy, I guess. So a lazy loafer is kind of saying the same thing twice, really.
Right. It basically a loafer is a slacker. It's someone who is habitually avoids work or lacks work ethic. Which I definitely would not classify George as either of those things, even at this point. I mean, we see his dedication to his work and you know. So I just found it really interesting that it once again shows, you know, that the tragedy that Gower is dealing with at this point is affecting him.
Yeah.
You know, the whole thing. And then he goes, "Mr. Gower, you don't know." And then he gets cut off. We're going to have to wait until tomorrow to find out what Mr. Gower does not know.
It's whacked a couple more times as well.
Yeah. He just keeps hitting him. So, yeah. This is a very... This is a somewhat difficult scene to watch because, you know, we know the reasoning behind everything. And, you know, and Mr. Gower doesn't. And he's just being very brutal to George. And, you know, he like hits him on the side of both sides of his head. You know, it's not just it. You know, on the one hand, George complains that he's hitting his sore ear, but he's hitting the other ear also.
Yeah. It's quite a raw scene, especially for its age. I mean, it's always... I think people have a misconception. They think old films are always a bit more sweetness and light, and especially It's a Wonderful Life. They remember the end and they think everything's all cheesy and happy. And it's like it can be quite tough and raw and kind of honest as well.
That's right.
It's
true. All right. Do you have anything else you want to say about this minute before we get into today's segment?
No, I think I covered it quite well. As I say, nicely shot and nicely performed. Nice, especially the Gower sequence. I do like that. But we'll get more into that later in the next episode.
I imagine. That's true. Tomorrow we'll come back to that. So every Monday I have a segment called Capra Monday, where my guest will give their top five movies directed by Frank Capra. So what have you got for us, David? Start with your number five and work your way up.
Five. Well, funnily enough, I realized when I put my name down for this is... Despite I do love my old movies, but I realized I hadn't actually seen that many of his films. I'd only seen about three.
J also only had the top three.
I've seen five now. I played catch up and I've seen. Actually, no, I think I'd seen four actually, but some of them I hadn't seen for ages either. And so I did a bit of a catch up, and I've ended up I've got loads into my belt now. But no, so yeah, so my number five, I'm going to go with Mr. Deeds Goes to Town. So that's one of the ones I saw a few weeks ago. Yeah, and that's a lot of fun. It's got a bit of the kind of Capricorn, if you wanted to call it, in there, a bit of cheese, but it's funny, it's light, it's enjoyable, and it's got a bit of his kind of political kind of side as well. Yeah, and number four is Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. This one might have been higher, but I didn't get a chance to rewatch this. This is one I've not seen for a long, long time, but I do remember liking it a lot. So I had to have it in the list, but I have it a bit lower down because I can't remember it. The next, number three, I'm going to go with It Happened One Night, which is a lot of fun. And I do like the way that the first half of the film, I was a little bit... I wasn't sure if I liked it or not, because I found the Clark Gable character quite unlikable. But then I think I figured that was kind of the point, and that he kind of turns around by and he wins you over by the end. And I really fell in love with the film by the end and adored it. Yeah, but my number two is Arsenic and Old Lace. So this is one I watched it recently in my kind of catch-up session. But I think I might have seen it before because it did seem familiar. But this is totally my wheelhouse, because this has none of the kind of idealistic kind of political side of Capra, or any of the corny side of Capra, which I don't mind because he does it very well. But here it is just real pitch black humor, and that's I love it, and it's just an absolute blast. It just kind of motors along at a ridiculous pace, and it's got some fantastic performances. It's just an absolute joy. But number one has still got to be It's a Wonderful Life, and it's just it. I've seen it so many times, and it never gets tired. And it's a very moving film. And then you get the super upbeat ending to cap it all off. As I say, it does pile things on a bit at the end. Like it's a very fast paced kind of barrage of uber happiness. But the film sells it. It works because of what's come before. It's quite a long film, but it's this story is compelling, and it builds to that. It sells that finale, as cheesy as it might be, and it's just a joy. Like, everything about it is just perfect. So it had to be number one.
Okay, great. Thank you very much for that. So, David, why don't you tell people where they can find David Burke?
Yeah, so I run blueprintreview.co.uk, where I review mainly home video kind of boutique Blu-ray releases and things like that. So, yeah, check it out.
All right. And while you're doing that, you can go review and subscribe to my podcast, my views, and listen to the show. Finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook. You can find me on Twitter. And you can find me on my website, movierobminute.com. So, until tomorrow. Hot dog.
I love you truly, truly dear. Life with its sorrow, life with its tears.